Welcome to the Ohana Life Podcast. I created this podcast to provide important information that would empower you on this journey of life that we are all in together. I bring two people that I found extremely helpful to me or are an inspiration in some unique way. I try to combine my knowledge and questioning with the way they serve society in their distinct roles. It takes a team, a holistic family of support to feel whole in our lives. I wanted to give them a larger voice to explain what they do and why. I'm a very curious person and like to learn, observe, critically think, and engage. The best knowledge I receive are the ideas that I can use immediately, and I hope you find that with these episodes. I personally am a movement educator, and each student is my mirror. They teach me about how I use words and how their bodies react to certain scenarios in a playful, safe space. I like to make sure they feel grounded and ready for what life has to offer. Life can be hard, and we can never know what to expect day to day, and I like to prepare them for real life scenarios. Students show me where my level of compassion is at as I watch stories of their lives unfold with each and every movement. It is a play and a delicate dance of intuition as we work together, so they get the most out of each hour we are together. I want to extend that into these one-hour podcast episodes and have some ideas of other ways life can be beautiful and you can shine in all scenarios, living life with grace and tenderness. These episodes do take time to create, finding the right person, hoping they say yes, sorting, researching, and gathering the topics and questions I want to ask, getting it published, and then releasing it in hopes that you are inspired after a short hour's time. I hope that you share it with others and research what these leaders provide and can find hope in difficult situations, whether they be movement, daily interactions, past dilemmas, and future ones to come. In this episode, I interviewed Kate O'Donnell. Kate specializes in Ayurvedic education, cooking skills, and cleansing programs. She offers online training, residential immersions, and individual consultations. These teachings help others come closer to their true nature. I've been trying to find someone to speak about Ayurveda for over 2 years now. It is the sister science to yoga and has its roots in food, balancing of the elements in the body, noticing when imbalances arise, and having preventative maintenance in your day-to-day lifestyle. I think of Ayurveda as a way to be empowered in your rituals, habits, and nutritional choices. It is a way to take control of your health. We spoke about the 6 steps to illness, why food is so important, what doshas are, and how to manage imbalances. I truly love that she travels to India yearly to keep up with her studies as yoga and Ayurveda are so closely linked. These are fundamental concepts that I hope you get so much out of. I'm including the links to her 3 books as well as how you can get in touch with her for her programs, classes, and workshops. Her first book has the seasons broken out with a shopping list of foods that are grown seasonally. The recipes are easy, delicious, and nutritious. I personally have that book and I'm ready to order the other 2. Feel free to reach out if you have any questions or to share what you learned out of this episode. I hope you have the best day.
Hi, Kate.
Hi. Hi, Lisa. Good to be here.
Thank you for being here today. So I've been really trying to find an Ayurvedic anybody for a couple of years now that would want to do this because I feel like Ayurveda is this missed science by many that is extremely helpful in our day-to-day for preventative maintenance. And it's hard for people to understand some of the concepts of it. So I thought maybe you could help us today just break down some of those concepts. Yeah. And I actually have your cookbook that I used to give for the teacher trainings, Everyday Ayurveda, and I'll probably link this in the show notes for it.
Yeah, super. Yeah.
So do you want to start by telling people just a little bit about you first?
Sure. I went to India when I was in college. I went to UNH, so that's how just for the listeners, how Lisa and I ended up connecting, because I grew up in New Hampshire and that's where she's broadcasting from today. And so it was during that time I went to South India, and that was where it all began. And I started yoga, you know, and I didn't start the Ayurveda. I started the yoga first. So I was a yoga teacher for about 20 years. I haven't taught for 3 or 4 years now. I started getting interested in Ayurveda because I had all these parasites from my travels over there. So I would go, and I still go to India every year or every other year. So I've been doing that since 98. And so my gut went through a lot those first couple trips, and that was how I got into Ayurveda. And it really blew me away, because it's a science, but there's also spirituality baked into it. And that's like what I had been looking for, you know, and also that your daily life, like things like what you eat, have a lot to do with your health. And that to me, I was like, yes, this is what I'm looking for. Like every action that I take over the course of a day can actually be beneficial. Mm-hmm. You know, if I understand sort of how these actions are affecting my body. So I felt like I got the idea just from my experience in my body of undergoing a panchakarma that first time in India. I think I was 21, and panchakarma is Ayurveda's, it's sort of like the top therapy, or like the crown jewel of the science, is this method or process that you can undergo when problems in the body are a little more progressed. It's not like something you just do willy-nilly. So it's something you usually do in a clinical setting. So I was sort of in South India, in this Ayurveda hospital for 3 weeks undergoing these treatments. And it just changed my understanding of my body, you know. And I was new to yoga at the time, but what I started to realize was that there's a lot in Ayurveda that actually speaks to yoga and helps me understand better how yoga works. You know, for that first 20 years, I was studying Ayurveda, but my vocation was teaching yoga. And so I was observing bodies all the time, you know, and how we work with yoga asanas and breathing techniques and stuff. And so the anatomy and physiology that underlie yoga systems is the same in Ayurveda. So I was able, through Ayurveda, I was able to learn anatomy and physiology from the Vedic perspective. And that to me is, that's where I get really excited. I get really jazzed up about that. And it's in that realm where there's this real interplay between the two systems. You know, and then as we boil it down, like we can do today, you know, these sort of epic, ancient, like millennial old traditions are still quite applicable today. And even, you know, something that originated in the Indian subcontinent, because the understanding of where you live on the planet and your relationship to, you know, the place where you live on the planet has a particular climate due to the relationship between the earth and the sun. Mm-hmm. Right. So everyone can sort of like take the science and apply it to where they are. I think that's one of the common misconceptions, is like, oh, there's all these Indian ingredients and all this information about like Indian climates, you know. But actually, if you understand how the system works, you just apply it to where you are, you know, and the kind of foods that are available to you. So that's been a lot of my work, I think, is sort of, I feel sometimes like a translator. Because I travel back and forth every year, you know, between India and New England, which are very different in terms of our climate and our bioregional cuisine and farming. So I've just naturally over the years sort of learned through self-taught, you know, how to do Ayurveda in New England, you know, or in the United States. Mm-hmm. I've traveled a lot. I've lived in a lot of different places and climates over the years. And it's been just really pivotal to me being healthy and feeling like I have that agency. Like before we started recording, you were talking about that feeling of empowerment, you know, about your health. And I think that's my interest in sharing Ayurveda with the public now. My passion remains as a student, for mm-hmm. sure, But I also feel like there's so much here, you know, that can help people get a leg up on how to interact with their own system, you know, and understand how it works and how it's affected by the environment and food and things like that. And then you start to do the work, you know, of choosing healthy things and feeling confident that your choices are healthy. And then everything just starts rolling in a positive direction.
Yeah. I think that if more people paid attention to what was going on in their body and really like listened every day, then it would start to feel better and better and better. And your choices are based on that. You know, your choices are based on what you're feeling and sensing and seeing and doing. And even just looking at food, you can tell, you know, if I go down the supermarket and I accidentally am down the aisle of crappy food or sodas or any of that, I actually feel ill just being there.
Right.
So let's go back to when you were in India. How long would you stay? Or do you stay?
The first couple of trips I would stay like 5 or 6 months.
Mm,
and you know, I was so young, I didn't really have a life that I had to come back to, you know, so I could do whatever. And as I took on more responsibilities as a human in my home place, I would stay usually somewhere between 2 and 4 months. Yeah, it's a long time. So, you know, I do feel like I've spent a lot of my life there, you know, and that informs how I understand Ayurveda and how I teach it.
And which part were you in?
So I'm usually in the south. I don't have a ton of experience in the northern parts of India. So around Chennai in Tamil Nadu, and also in Karnataka, which is where Mysore is. And that's where Ashtanga Yoga, the seat of Ashtanga Yoga is. So I spent a lot of time there with my yoga teacher. But interestingly enough, the Panchakarma Center where I now study with the doctors there is in Coimbatore, which is kind of on the Tamil Nadu Kerala line. And it's actually like a 5-hour car ride from Mysore. And so a lot of my trips over the past 10 years have been between those two places.
So you studied with Pattabhi Joyce?
I did. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And then he left his body, I want to say 2011. And I continued working with his grandson and his daughter.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been to Karnataka state and I went to the Drepungulmang monastery there. So yeah. I stayed there and it was definitely interesting. And I have to say that I had lined up all on my desk in my room, all of the homeopathics, and every day it was like testing and just kind of assessing how am I, because when you're alone there, the healthcare system is not the same and you really do have to step up to your own healing.
Right.
You know, they were very good to me there though. They always had the food cooked and I was not eating what they were eating. They were cooking me my own foods that didn't have as many spices, I don't think, I think they were really concerned about diarrhea.
Right, yeah.
Which I only got the one time we went out of the facility and it was immediate, yeah.
right, yeah, you can imagine how it was for me that first trip. I went everywhere for 6 months. I was an absolute mess by the end of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, now it's fine. You know, I don't get sick anymore. And things have changed a lot in India in the past 20 years as well.
So the parasites, do you think were from food and water, both?
I mean, maybe. I think food is more maybe. Likely. I can trace it to certain restaurants, the times that it's happened.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I know quite a bit about Ayurveda. I'm not good at conveying it as well. And I have not had any training in any of these institutions, but I know enough for me to get by for my own personal self. So I don't know, should we start out with the basics of Ayurveda, or do we start out with maybe the six or five stages of illness? And when you get to that lowest one, maybe there's no going back, but should we start with those levels of illness and then why Ayurveda, or should we back into it the other way and start with some of the basics?
I mean, I like that. I like that question. So you're talking about the Samprapti, which is like the pathogenesis of disease. And there's, so there's six different steps. I mean, I like to talk about different things every time, which, so this is great because you didn't ask me to explain the doshas. So I'm kind of relieved.
We will have to talk about them at some point, but yeah. I think if people understand illness,
yeah,
and how we can cut it off at the pass, then we can back into it. Yeah.
Right. So these doshas, which we can explain, right? Those are the components in human bodies that were identified by the, we could say the acharyas, which are like the ancient seers of India, right? Those sort of Vedic scholars, as well as physicians. So they, you know, over through these, all these thousands of years of trial and error observing bodies, they identified these three kind of compounds that are always at the heart of a disease process. And those are called doshas. Mm-hmm. And Vata, Pitta, and Kapha are their names, and they each have different functions and physiological functions in the body, which they're great when they're behaving themselves. But the point the acharyas make is that they're faulty. So the word dosha means that which is faulty. And so there's these faulty aspects of a human body that tend to get messed up, and then they make problems. And so there's very early signs and symptoms of problems, which if we were having a textbook conversation about illness, right? Mm-hmm. It, according to Ayurveda, begins in the digestive tract. Mm, yes. As the home of these faulty compounds, each of these doshas has a home in one of the digestive organs, stomach, small intestine, large intestine. And so that's why we talk about food and digestion and poop and all that stuff all the time, right?
Yeah. Talking about poop is like, I know it sounds gross to some people who don't know about it, but we're so concerned with the way it looks and the texture and, you know, what comes in must come out. And does it come out putrid? Does it come out smooth? You know, these are all things that we care about.
Yes. Yeah. What your poo is telling you, right? Mm-hmm. About your health. So the early signs and symptoms of imbalances. So we'll use that word imbalance, right? To sort of describe, because it's not a disease yet. Mm-hmm. It's just something's going a little wonky. So you're farting all the time, or you're burping all the time, right? Or you're like not hungry. You don't have a good appetite. So those are like the first signs. Right. So if you notice that you're not hungry, you're probably going to change the way that you eat. But most people are, oh, it's breakfast time, I'm going to eat breakfast anyway. Mm-hmm. Right. And so if you sort of aren't listening to early signs and are just going about your business and continue to put food in the digestive tract as though there are no symptoms, we could change the food. It doesn't mean you have to fast necessarily, but maybe you eat different qualities of foods, you know, when you realize that these things are going on. And so when those early signs are not managed, which again is that word we'll use a lot, like managing the doshas, they're like crazy little kids, you know. It's like being a kindergarten teacher, having a body, right? You've got these crazy things running around inside the digestive tract. And if you don't sort of manage those early signs, like the gas, the bloating, the burping, or the loss of appetite, you'll find yourself accumulating the imbalance, right? And then say your gas and bloating starts to, you know, impact a little bit, and you end up not pooping good, like you're constipated, or your burping turns into like hyperacidity. Mm-hmm. Right. Or your lack of appetite turns into like a feeling of nausea. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, that's like your second stage of problems where they're a little more in your face.
Yeah.
You know, and it's harder to ignore. But the thing is, that's interesting, is if we follow this pathway of observing signs and symptoms, you can trace things back to their original cause, which is a big part of how we treat disease and imbalance in Ayurveda, is to go all the way back to the causative factors.
Gotcha.
Because otherwise you can fix it, but it'll come back if you don't remove the causative factor.
Right.
So then you get into, if you, the second stage, if that comes and goes and it's not managed, and you end up with aggravation. And that's where you might have like reflux, you know, trying to come out, or, you know, like the constipation is affecting your ability to sort of do in this third stage, your ability to just be normal is affected by the symptoms, right? So acid reflux, like imagine you're in a Zoom meeting, you're like, oh, excuse me, you know, or like you're having trouble just like sitting there because you're so constipated, right? Or the nausea is leading to sort of congestion, you know, so you're all bogged down, you have brain fog and things like that. And as if the aggravation isn't managed, which you're still within the early stages that a lot of our basic preventive measures can dial it back. When you're in the third stage, you're still all the stuff we talk about in this podcast today can still turn that stuff around.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's once you move past that into the fourth, fifth, and sixth stage, things start. So in that third stage, things can start to spread. Right. And so that's where a hyperacidity, you might end up with inflammation moving around in your blood, giving you skin problems, you know, so that's where you see more kind of skin stuff. The digestive disturbances can turn into things like IBS, right, where it's like it's more chronic and the symptoms are not obvious and easy anymore. It's like it's alternating between this and that, and the other thing, right? It becomes more difficult to tell. And once something is spreading through the body, it's looking for a place to lodge. Like inflammation is an example I think a lot of people can wrap their head around, you know, because inflammation can range in the blood, but then lodge in the tissues of the body somewhere and be a precursor for cancer, for example, you know. And so that's when you want to seek out an Ayurvedic professional, you know, an Ayurvedic practitioner. You might get into the use of herbs. You know, they might want to pack you off for a panchakarma at some point, you know, but once something's lodged in the tissues, that's the fourth stage. And then it starts to actually deteriorate the tissue. And that's a disease when you get there. So your tissues are being affected. And then that's the fifth stage. And the sixth stage is kind of untreatable. So that would be terminal illness. And there is palliative care for sure. And I should say that Ayurveda works nicely with Western medicine. It's not an either or kind of a thing. And I like that about it, is that in a lot of cases of more progressed illnesses and disease processes, we might end up having to use Western medicines, which are very effective, you know, and save lives and keep people a lot more comfortable than they might be otherwise. But there's a lot of side effects with these, which is just another great argument to sort of get signs of imbalance managed earlier on, right? But if you do end up, you know, in a situation where, for example, your meds are affecting your, say, your cognitive abilities or your digestion, your appetite, right? There's a lot of things we can do with Ayurveda to sort of manage the side effects of a drug that you might need to be on when you're in a deeper state of disease or imbalance. So it's like a very full spectrum medicine.
It really is. And I think that sometimes people check out of or try to mask any of these stages, especially the first three, yeah, as just like aging, normal aging, or staying up too late, or just they kind of chalk it up to that stuff instead of really staying attuned to it. And I think the empowerment piece, the being in charge piece, is in those three steps of, you know, you can really help these by going back to the root cause, finding the root cause and working with a practitioner quite a bit to get that done. And food. Food's a big piece. So I guess, just as a quick recap of the doshas. So there's vata, pitta, and kapha. Is that how you say it? Kapha?
Yep.
Okay. So do you want to give just a tiny abridged version of the three?
yeah, absolutely. Right. So if we look at this, the most basic anatomy, it's an elemental composition of the body, like Chinese medicine, similar, different elements, but same kind of idea, right? Where we break the body down into these five elements that each have different qualities, like earth is heavy, water is moist, mm-hmm. fire is hot, air is mobile, right? It moves. Like if you look at the sky and there's a cloud up there, it's never just sitting there.
Right.
It's always moving. So there's this movement quality in bodies. And then the space element is sort of like the field in which everything is moving, right? So space is like your whole mouth to your anus is a space, mm-hmm. the whole digestive tract. That's the largest space in the body, actually, that mm-hmm. sort of central channel where that's where it all goes down, because that's where, because it's the biggest space, it's got the most of everything in it, right? Kind of stuffed in there. So there's the fire doing the transformation and the digestion of our food. There's the air moving through the space, which creates the peristalsis. So like, you know, when you eat food, you don't go to food school, you know, it's like your body already knows there's already these existing currents of digestion and circulation, right? And that's your vata that does that. That this combination of air and space elements, because air without space can't move, right? So the space is like the forms that the air is moving in the body, and that creates the currents, like our veins, our arteries, our digestive tract, right? Those are all these kind of tubes that stuff is constantly in movement. And so vata means that which moves. And so the job of that dosha physiologically is to do all the processes in the body that require movement. So like peeing and pooping, you know, and your blood pumping, your lymph moving and detoxifying, right? And also your attention. And so the mind is an important aspect here also. And is a causative factor for a lot of problems, I might add. So my second book is about the mind.
Is that out yet?
Oh yeah. Yep. Yep.
I don't have that one yet.
Yeah. That one is called Everyday Ayurveda Cooking for a Calm, Clear Mind.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. And so that one is about for the yogis, you know, you will have heard of sattva.
Yeah.
Sattva, rajas, tamas. So I wrote about sort of how we understand the mind in that book, because it's such a big story, but vata is a lot of the governing of the movements of the mind. Mm-hmm. It's like the clouds in the sky, the mind is never still. Mm-hmm. It's always moving, which is often problematic, right? I think
it's a little bit more vata heightened in our society right now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So this dosha called pitta is the hot one. It's fire and water. So the water is the container for fire, because otherwise the fires, it would just burn everything, right? And so it's contained in sort of a moisture base. So that gives us things like stomach acid and red blood, which are both moist and very hot, right? So the red blood is moving around, keeping the body warm. The stomach acids, the liver enzymes, all that stuff is digesting and absorbing our food. So this pitta does the transformation of information into comprehension. So like when you read, you know, you read some heady book, that's your pitta actually. That's like computing all the information. And then it's also doing gross as well as subtle transformations of our food into nutrition. Mm. And your kapha, that's where you get all your moisture. And you're building your tissue qualities. So it's earth and water. That's the third of the three compounds, a combination of earth and water. Because if you try to build a sandcastle with dry sand, right, there's no cohesion to it. So the water, the moisture is necessary there. So kapha is responsible for like anabolic activity, holding things together, maintaining homeostasis, building the body. Because if you just had pitta, you'd disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Everything would be digested and transformed. So kapha like opposes that with this heavy, moist, dense, cool qualities. And so that makes up your mucous membranes, your white blood cells and lymphatic fluids, and like the, you know, the saliva and the moisture on the eyes, in the joints, you know, the skin, getting that night, you know, having natural like sebaceous secretions. So all of those nice moist things come from kapha and all of our mucus.
We want all three in our body, but if we come into trouble when one is a little bit more heightened than another. So kapha, if there's too much saliva or too much mucus, we're now running into like pneumonia, chest issues.
Yeah. Allergies, sinus problems, diabetes is a condition it's further along, but it has its roots in excessive moisture in a kapha problem. Obesity, difficulty losing weight, a tendency towards stagnation. So kapha types just need to exercise. They need to avoid eating heavy food all the time, you know, like meat and white bread and that sort of like sticky, heavy stuff, and just exercise. And that's the best way to manage that dosha. So you don't
I think, when they're out of balance, there's a lot of that get up and go is just a little bit harder, but they could kind of choo-choo train their way through a day nonstop and kind of forget not to eat. But then when they do, it might be this big, heavy to sustain again.
Which is a great example of how our mental state can affect, you know, our habits, which then start to cause these habitual behaviors, which maybe we don't notice, but they're starting to make problems.
So long-term on imbalance in one of these three constitutions could affect the six stages of imbalance.
So the way it happens, right, is one of these doshas starts to get out of balance, either because of it can undergo qualitative or quantitative changes. So something like kapha, the example we're in, which is great because spring is considered the kapha time of year. They have similar qualities to kapha. So a qualitative change means like your mucus becomes like thicker or stickier, right? Or starts to dry out. For example,
opposite. Yeah. Okay.
Right. So like any of those kind of changes can occur and it starts to cause problems in the physiological function of this kapha that's trying to do all these jobs in your body. And so the signs and symptoms are early. So for example, here, say you lose your appetite. So you eat a bunch of ice cream in a damp season. It goes on for a couple of days in a row. And then you wake up on Thursday and you're like, I'm not hungry for breakfast today. That's so odd. You know, like I'm usually hungry. And so I'm just going to eat my breakfast because I have to go to work. So you eat on top of that sort of like undigested, goopy, sticky, dairy type business, you know, that's been like growing in there for a few days. And then that the qualities of that kapha starts to get like thicker in there. You might also have quantitative changes. So there's more mucus in there, right? And then if it's not managed and you just go about your business, the mucus in the stomach is kind of a gross example, but hey, you know, so that mucus, these qualities of kapha in the stomach, they get too big for that organ. And then they're going to start looking to spread because it's accumulated and then it's aggravated and now it wants to spread. And so it might end up in your sinuses or in your lungs. Those are the closest places to your stomach. So it's most likely we're going to see something like that. People might have the brain fog after they eat at that point. They might have excess saliva, right? A boggy feeling in the head, which might then make them more susceptible to head colds and allergies and things like that, right? So then we get all of these other problems that can easily take over a body because there's this trajectory of imbalance going on. And so the thing about a dosha that makes it so problematic is once it goes off, once it undergoes some of these changes, it's kind of exponentially continues to move in that direction, in that trajectory towards imbalance, unless we introduce some opposite qualities. So like you have some lemon hot lemon cayenne water instead of having the breakfast on Thursday when you felt kind of boggy in your stomach. So you put something hot and dry in there to increase the stomach acid to start to break down that like goopy ice cream stuff that's hanging around. Mm. Right. So that's how we change the trajectory so that a dosha doesn't like move its way along through these six stages. It takes a long time, right? I mean, it's going to take a decade for your ice cream situation, right, in 1995 to sort of like grow into this problem. And so there's so many opportunities to notice the problems. Once we understand the language or the lens of how Ayurveda looks at mucus and poop and acid and all that stuff, then there's so many opportunities to intercede or intervene, I should say, along that trajectory and start to turn things around so that it moves back into its relative state of balance.
Isn't it so interesting? I mean, this is why I love Ayurveda, because it directly affects our day-to-day and the food we eat. It's us. It's everything about us. I love it.
Yeah.
So you deal mostly with the food aspects, or are you an Ayurvedic practitioner? Do you have people come to you for that?
I am. I will say though, that what happened, Lisa, was, you know, I started practicing Ayurveda with people one-on-one. I had already been in the practice of observing bodies for 20 years as a yoga teacher, right? So all the yoga people listening, you know what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. You see your mucus and you see the inflammation, you see all that stuff walking in and out of your door. And then I started working with people, and you know, I don't love to jump towards things like herbal medicines and herbs, and a lot of the medicines that we take are digestibles. So your body has to digest it, right? In order for a medicine to work, it has to be digested. And so if somebody's diet is causing digestive problems and I'm giving them herbs, we really do have to address the diet.
Right.
We really have to, you know? And what happened to me in my first couple of years of practice was I was just seeing all of these problems in people's relationship to food.
Food, yeah.
And especially the activity of cooking, of preparing food, because that my Ayurvedic doctor, that first doctor, I was like, what's the one thing? You know, as I go back to America, what's the one thing that I can like really do, you know, just to stay on this path? And he was like, don't take outside food so much. Mm-hmm. Like eat in the home, you know? And I saw a lot of problems with people eating sort of restaurant food a lot or takeout or that sort of thing. And just not taking time.
I also think the problem is that we have food available all year round. So even though asparagus is available all year round, it doesn't mean we should be eating it then. It's more of a spring food.
Right. Good point. Right. So our food chain's a little wet.
I mean, it's great. We have it available, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it should be eaten that time of year.
Yeah.
Before we get into the more of the food, do you want to give maybe some of the day-to-day preventative stuff? Like for me, I tongue scrape, I drink, you know, room temperature water first thing in the morning. I don't do the neti pot, but I, you know, swishing, all that. Like, what would you say are the top things that you would recommend before the food?
Right.
People could be doing.
Yeah. Morning practices. And so this is in like the early parts of the texts, you know, about Ayurveda. It starts with this like daily prevention for normal people, right? So there are things that a normal, healthy person can do for longevity. Mm-hmm. And it's called dinacharya, which means sort of daily routines or the way the day goes, right? And this is where you start to own your connection to your health and to your future, you know? So while the way that dinacharya works is that while the body is asleep, because we're not eating and we haven't eaten for a number of hours, right? Which goes back to an earlier dinner, you know, if we can get the dinner happening like close to 7, that's great, because then there's a couple hours, hopefully, before we go to bed, and the body is naturally moves into an organ and blood detox from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. And you will find that repeated in other indigenous medicines. There's something going on in the middle of the night, right? Where the liver cleans the blood, the digestive organs begin to detoxify, the blood is being detoxed, and all the detox comes into the digestive tract.
Yeah.
Because it's the biggest space in the body and it's got two really big holes at either end, right? Where wastes can be removed from the body. That's what the morning practices are about, helping the body remove wastes. And so you've got your bum in your mouth. Again, gross, but two ends of the same, right, of the same
They're
thing.
Important. So
if there's gunk trying to get out of the digestive tract, it's going to crawl up or down. Right. And so the tongue scraping is how we remove that sort of mucus factor from the stomach. And it's a great practice because when you scrape your tongues, so you can use sort of a stainless steel copper tongue scraper. You can buy them like everywhere now. I think you'll find them at like a apothecary, natural food store kind of thing. You scrape the tongue like 5 or 6 times with this metal horseshoe shaped thing, and you'll see mucus come off your tongue. And so then you're not digesting that, right? So that's been removed.
And we don't want to swallow that back down.
Right, right. So the first thing you do when you get up is you do that and you take a pee. And if you have to poop, you take a poop, which seems obvious, but sometimes people suppress these natural urges, which done regularly, that suppression starts to cause a backflow and you'll have trouble with urination and poop, you know, down the line. It might take a few years, but so you scrape the tongue, you pee, you poop, you clean the mouth, which to us looks like brushing our teeth, right? And then some people like to do oil pulling. That's especially helpful for people who have any receding of the gums. Mm-hmm. It's because it brings this moisture to the mouth and it further detoxifies the body.
Right.
I don't want people to think like you have to do it all though. I would say take home message is tongue scrape, clean the mouth, drink hot water.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So hot / warm, depending on your climate. Like if hot water feels bad to you, then warm is fine. But think about like when you do your dishes, you don't use cold water. Right. So we're kind of cleaning the pipes. We're just cleaning the pipes and hot water. It softens and loosens impurities along the channels.
Mm.
Right. So that's just, we're getting gunk, which is going to look a lot like mucus to us. So we're just getting the gunk in an easy to digest form. We're removing some of it with the tongue scraper. And then it's, you know, it's ideal to then not eat until there is a true appetite. So some people might take their, this is where yoga is a great practice because it's kind of baked into the method that you don't practice after food. So it's a good morning thing. A lot of people
it's a good morning
stuff
thing,
in the morning. Yeah. And so it's on an empty stomach. And so you're going to get further detoxification there by doing exercise or breathing practice or whatever in the morning. If you're looking for purification of the mind, which I'd like to make a big plug for, that's where sort of contemplative practices, reading of inspirational texts or pranayama, breathing techniques, meditation, you know, you use your meditation app, you know, there's so many ways to do purification of the mind at this point. And so if all that stuff, which will take you 10 or 15 minutes, right? If all that stuff happens before you look at the news, right? Before you eat, before all of that's happening, you've done this sort of purification. And if somebody does that consistently, like most of the time, I mean, of course we have our crazy days where we skip it and we just go out to brunch and go nuts. I think it's good to blow it all out of the water sometimes so that we remain resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And able to withstand changes. But I think, if we're doing it like 80% of the time, there's going to be a longevity aspect to that.
I think when people, so again, with our society, it's rush to work. I got to get to work. Yeah. All right. How many hours do I have before I have to get to work? Okay. If I have to be there at 7, I'm going to get up at 6. My coffee is the first thing. And so coffee tends to be that main driver for people to get through the day. Whereas I think if they understood that these steps are an even better way to get through the day, then it would just be done more. I mean, these are huge pieces to staying healthy, body, mind, but getting rid of the detox.
Yeah.
Makes you feel less shitty.
Absolutely. Yeah. Making a little time for poop in the morning is so great, you know, and that's where just having some quiet time. That's where I like seated practices in the morning. And then there's yoga techniques, you know, that'll make you poop. Like squatting is a great example. Mm-hmm. You know, so people, while they drink their hot water, can squat on a block or something, you know, and it's going to keep you flexible into your old age. And it's going to induce a bowel movement just to kind of squat and hang and not be like moving around and running around. And a lot of the problems I've seen with digestion, that these problems that look very serious can easily be remedied just by taking a poop in the morning before you start running around and before you eat.
Yeah, bowel movements are extremely important. And in Ayurveda, is it one a day or one after every meal? What is the perfect bowel movement?
The perfect poop, yeah. It's generally once a day. Yeah. In the morning, you know, size, shape, and consistency of a banana, that kind of thing. It doesn't have to be after every meal. That might be considered a little fast. Actually, we just want to ensure.
Like a higher pitta?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So we just want to ensure that there's time for assimilation, you know, and it depends on the person. Some people it's natural and for them to poop twice a day. Other people once a day is natural. It's when we're only pooping like twice a week or something that, or we're pooping a lot in one day that we start to see it affect the body in deeper ways.
Okay. So let's go to your cookbook. Okay. So the one I have is broken up by season, which is fantastic. So you have kind of grocery lists per season and then a mix, a sweet one, and then sort of the mix for the season that you could season your foods with. Yeah. So what I would do is at the beginning of the season, I make the mix, both of the mixes, and then you just leave it by your stove or wherever it needs to be. And then it's just there and ready for you, ready to go. I do love the grocery list setup. Although, you know, living in New Hampshire, you know, the seasons are very distinct. Yes. So you know what foods are available, literally, and which ones are nowhere to be found. So it is easy to kind of follow this schedule that you have of food because they are really only available during those times anyway. So people who live in warmer climates might have that food more available for longer periods of time. But you said that, you know, everything's adaptable anyway. Do you want to tell us maybe your insight into why you did create this? And I will link it.
So the Everyday Ayurveda Cookbook, that one I did divide into the four seasons. And the seasons are honestly code for the doshas. Right. Because each of these doshas has qualities, like we describe kapha, you know, is heavy, cool, moist, sticky. And so we practice the medicine of opposites for prevention in Ayurveda. So at a time of year where the climate is also cold, heavy, and moist, it's likely that our bodies, by proxy, will also become a little more dry, heavy and moist, which for someone who, cool, heavy, moist, right? Sticky. Where for somebody who needs moisture in their body, that might feel great, right? And springtime might come as a big relief to them. But for people with a constitution, that's all where they already have a lot of these earth and water elements, that could be a difficult time of year for them. So the general principle in an Ayurvedic diet for a normal, healthy person is that we shift our diet seasonally. So as the qualities of our climate change, we balance that by introducing opposite qualities in our food. So if it's really rainy, you eat something kind of dry, a little less fatty on that day, right? And if it's really dry, you eat something moist, like we might reach for more avocado or put a little more oils in our salad dressing. If it's cold out, we eat hot, warm food. Mm-hmm. If it's hot out, we eat refreshing and cooling foods, right? And so when you look at those seasonal grocery lists, that's what they are. Just examples of cooling and refreshing foods for the summer, foods that just start to warm you up in the fall. We're going to increase the moisture and fats because fall is dry compared to the summer, right? And then as the winter goes on, it gets colder and drier. So you might start to see maybe a little onion, a little chili, you know, definitely warm foods, no salads, that sort of thing as you go through the winter. More root vegetables. It's the time of year for meats for people who eat the non-vegetarian food. And then we hit the spring and it's like, you know, it's raining.
Let's get the
mucusy. Yeah. That's where we go for our greenery and our, you know, you start to get the fruits going again. And it's just that to follow this rhythm with nature it's a natural way of balancing the trajectory that doshas might get on during the season. So one of the causative factors for early imbalances is seasonal changes. So we balance that by changing our food. So it's not like you get hit upside the head, you know, by all this heavy and moist and damp and sticky business all of a sudden. You're working with it by eating, say, quinoa, right? Instead of bread. Mm-hmm. Which I think for people who are paying attention, a lot of these changes are natural. You start to crave, right? Yes. These things. And that's how you know the Ayurveda is working for you, when you start to crave things with opposite qualities to
the weather, outside external environment. I know two stories. One, my son used to get these like cracks in the winter on the side of his lip, and then that big red ring. You know, that the dry ring under their lips. And Ayurveda, you know, they were like a cold apple in a winter day, warm the apple, maybe add a little bit of butter. And when he stopped eating the raw apples, it totally went away, you know, because it was his body saying, the apple's fine. The way you introduce it into the body just needs to be a little different.
Right.
I knew this elderly gentleman. He was older, in his 80s, and the house he was living at, they were giving, you know, cold salads in the winter. So, you know, he's at the Vata stage of life, and then it's the Vata time of year. And then he's eating these foods that are for summer. And he was just getting very ill all the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, his food needs to be warm, heated, you know, to help assist this. Right. I mean, it's really common. Did you ever read the book One Bowl book?
Mm-mm. No.
It was sort of this idea of like, you find a bowl that fits in your hand well, and then all your foods would kind of go in it. It's a good size, but it's also like you seek out the foods that you like want. So you're not just in this like farm to table where you would just have all the options or given all the options and you don't know what to do. This is like, you seek it out, you look and you try to understand, well, what does my body want? And I feel like Ayurveda is like that. There's the circadian rhythm of the day, but then there's also of the seasons and saying, okay, well, if I'm in tune and everything's kind of in balance, then what is it that my body actually wants to eat? You know, my daughter's really good at this. She'll just open the fridge and be like, no, 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 no. It's like, she knows she needs something specific. She doesn't know why or what, but it's this absolutely not. And not just to eat.
Yeah.
Type of thing. Yeah. So what's your second book about?
The second book is about the mind, which when you get into the mind, you end up in the territory of yoga a lot more than in Ayurveda, actually. And so the There is a language, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. Rajas and Tamas are called the doshas of the mind. And so there's a similar sort of imbalanced trajectory that happens in the mind. And there is actually descriptions of foods and their effects on Rajas and Tamas, these doshas of the mind. And so that book is divided according to sattvic foods, foods to calm down a rajasic state, to motivate a tamasic state. Yeah. So that one is a lot about the mind and also the nervous system, because that's kind of
nervous system is like another thing that is such king of every physical thing that we do and the mind. And I don't think it's talked about enough.
Yeah. Which is exactly why I wrote that book, you know. And some of my readers, they'll say, I mean, everybody loves that first book, right? Who doesn't love cooking through the seasons? So it's like you get all this variety and it's nice. But some people do come and tell me that second book was actually even more profound for them, because for whatever reason, it was the nervous system that was actually the causative factor for them.
Well, I think they need both. You have to eat well in order for your mind to be well, right?
Absolutely.
Mind and nervous system to be well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that kind of needed its own book, I felt, in order for me to do it justice. Mm-hmm. And then people
when
who are
did that one come out?
The third book, that one is not a cooking book. That one is a self-care book. So for people who just want to go deep into seasonal rituals and routines and daily routines, that's the third book, which is the guide to self-care, everyday Ayurveda guide to self-care.
I'm loving the theme, the everyday cookbook, self-care book.
Yep, exactly. Which the idea there is that you want to work on it a little bit every day, mm-hmm. you know, and just make it a part of your life slowly over time. So that was why I put everyday in the title.
Yeah. When I did the teacher training, we had it for say 10 months or so. And so it was optional, but I said, okay, well, for the first month, if you want, wake up every morning and just drink some room temperature or hot water. That was just the first month. And I was like, oh, well, that was okay. And then the second month I was like, now if you want,
yeah,
that was great. You know,
so
by the end of 10 months, there was like this layered on approach of, and then when it was at the end of that, it was like, well, no, but I want to dry brush and tongue scrape and do, you know, and drink my water, because you see how beneficial it is to really have self-care, which is empowerment, which manages any balance that you need to have in your body and mind to be able to tackle what is going on in the world.
Yeah. 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 Well, I can tell you that's dear to your heart and an important part of your life.
Well, for me, yeah, personally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great.
And you too. That's why I'm so glad that you wanted to do this, because I think it's, if more people understood that we are more in charge of what we do and how we do it based on the external environment, especially winter, you know, because winter can feel barren and like we don't have control, I think that things just get easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm in total agreement. That's really at the heart of most of my work. Yeah. Otherwise, if I didn't care about that, I think I'd be a little more of a hermit. You know, so I write these books and it's like a very solitary, obnoxious thing to be doing in life. And so talking about my books with people and like speaking to readers it's the way that I bring it all together. So I appreciate your platform and your people. And I hope that there's something here for everybody.
There's definitely something here for everybody. So where can we find you? The website? I'll send them to the book links.
Sure.
Can they find you?
Yeah. So another problem I was seeing with some people was they would have the book, but not actually open it. So I did make some sort of companion courses. So I have online courses of differing lengths and intensities that are available through my site, which is ayurvedicliving.institute. So you can put that in the show notes and people can check it out. There's also cooking workshops. There's live workshops if people want to, like, you know, meet me and do live stuff. So there's a lot there. There's a lot there. So it's divided into self-care workshops, cooking workshops, and then master classes, which are longer things that could go on for 6 months to a year.
How long does it take you to write a book?
I would say in the beginning, it was a year. And then it was a year and a half for the next one. And then it was more like 2 years for the third one. And now I'm working on the fourth one, which I have been sitting on for 2 years. You know, I had the idea and made the proposal to my publisher 2 years ago. But I think it's because there's a certain amount of pain that one undergoes in a project like that. And so I get a little slower about jumping in. But it's
the world is slowing down a little bit. So you should match that. Right, when is your next trip to India?
That's a good question. I mean, it's possible I'll go in the new year. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to say. I mean, there's so much going on, globally.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, if it's not this coming winter, it'll be the next one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for being on here. I appreciate it so very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Lisa. It's good to meet you and speak with your community.
Thank you so much for listening. I wanted to update you all on the studio. As of right now, when this podcast comes out, we will no longer be at the physical location of 44 Cedar Street. Please check out our website at ohanayoganh.com, as we will still be doing events, we will still be doing classes through Zoom, and we will keep you posted on our new location. This one will be very big, so be prepared for what's to come in the future, and I hope you all have the best day.